It's the Todd Ortloff Show on News Radio KONP. Now, here's Todd.
And welcome once again to the program. First segment today, we're going to talk about something that's kind of a fixture around here, but you may not know a lot about it. Actually, there's two parts to this that are kind of a fixture. Many people know about First Fed, as in the bank. I've been around a long time as a local bank, but many of you may or may not know about its Community Foundation, which does a tremendous amount of donating work around our area. And we're going to talk a bit more about that and a little bit more about the impact the Community Foundation from First Fed has had here with a couple of folks that have been directly involved. First up, we're going to talk with Karen McCormick. Karen, was involved at First Fed for about 32 years. Was a founding executive director of their foundation. That was in 2015 and is currently a board member as well. Karen, it's great to talk to you again. Thanks for coming on today.
Well, thank you, Todd. I am delighted to participate today and grateful for the opportunity to tell our story.
So let's roll back to 2015. Let's give you a chance to talk about the formation of this foundation, which really has grown into quite something here.
Yes, indeed. It really is. It's born of the legacy that First Federal has in the communities that we've served. And I am so proud to still be affiliated with this wonderful little community bank, which is now in its 100th year from its inception in 1923. Giving back has always been a part of First Federal's identity. Pretty much any community event, large or small, First Fed has just always been there. So when the bank went public in 2015, it seemed natural that the board would take steps to ensure that that legacy of giving lived well on into the future. It created the First Federal Community Foundation and funded it with cash and stock that was valued at nearly $12 million. The foundation has one donor, that's First Federal. We do not do any kind of fundraising as a result. I want to mention here, what's truly amazing is that unlike so many other corporations that create foundations, First Federal didn't stop giving once it created its foundation. The bank continues to give on its own as well. An example is the $2 million that it just gave to the Field Arts and Events Hall. That didn't come from the foundation. That came from the bank.
That's a good point. That's a distinction, too. And if I understand this correctly, I mean, the bank is still funding into the foundation as well as part of the part of its philanthropic effort in addition as it moves forward. So, Karen, this has been pretty interesting for you, I would think, because, you know, your involvement is, formerly in charge of things at the bank, now, kind of shifting gears, still involved, as you mentioned, but now on a charity board, basically.
Yes, yes, it is truly a wonderful experience. It was quite different for me. I started, went from the banking world into the nonprofit world. It was quite a transition, and it opened my eyes to many different things, primarily the hard work that those nonprofits are doing out there. They are truly superheroes. They're absolutely amazing what they get done in the communities. We don't always see them or hear about them, but they are just doing so much, particularly in the last few years.
Describe, Karen, if you will, who's on the board and a bit of kind of the function of how the board works for the foundation.
Sure. The board of directors, we have our chairman of the board is Norm Tanina. He's just a tremendous individual who's been a leader for both the foundation. He's also on the bank board. We have our treasurer is Candy Avery. She's a CPA who specializes in nonprofits and is very dedicated to them as well. Lori Hawkins is the secretary of the foundation, and she, too, has worked with many different foundations in the last few years. Cindy Finney is also a director. She's recently been named the new chairman of the board for First Federal Bank. We're very proud and very, very happy. The bank is in excellent hands. And Dania Bihar is also with our board. He was recently elected to the foundation board, has a tremendous background with philanthropic giving as well. And in addition to the board, we have Jan Simon, who is our executive director. Jan came to us with a tremendous background with nonprofits, and we are so lucky to have her. She's extremely dedicated to not only the foundation, but to the nonprofits that we serve.
So let's talk about kind of you as a board. You make those decisions as to who, taking applications, the types of giving that's going to happen. Describe, if you will, kind of how that process works.
You bet. We have two grant cycles each year, one in the spring and one in the fall. We have 60-day windows where we can accept applications, and that is all done through our website, which is www.firstfedcf.org. The website has all the information you could possibly want about our programs. During the windows, we have our application there, and as well as contact information for Jan. From the beginning, we've sought to meet immediate needs in the community, immediate cash needs, but more importantly, we seek to invest in the communities we serve. So to that end, we established four different giving priorities for the foundation. The first one's a little different from the others. This is community support. These are the smaller grants between $5,000 and $25,000. And essentially what we seek to do is improve the quality of life by building the capacities of the nonprofits in our areas to meet the needs that are growing. Now, during the pandemic, we typically allocate about $50,000 to that for each cycle. But during the pandemic, we added quite a bit more there to meet emergency needs. The other three are more aligned towards the investing in our community area. We have affordable housing that builds on a First Federal's legacy of providing decent, safe, and affordable housing for low to moderate income families and people. We are focusing now on workforce housing, which is an emerging need in all of our communities as well. The other two priorities are economic development. That's all about creating jobs and economic opportunity. And community development, which is typically our larger capital projects that benefit broad segments of the communities. So we typically, each cycle, we give about $400,000. We allocate $50,000 to the community support and $350,000 to the other three categories. We seek to balance between those priorities as well as amongst the various communities that we receive or that we fund. What's really interesting is that we always receive each cycle since we began at least 4 to 5 times the amount of requests than we have money to give, which is very telling about the need that that is out there. But I'm very proud to say that from 2015 through May of this year, our foundation has given out over $5.7 million in grants to the communities we serve. And that's a record that's I think, a little hard to match.
it's pretty amazing, actually, when you talk about it as well. Could you describe a bit? I mean, there was the seed of money that was put into there when First Fed went public back in 2015. Is this drawing entirely just off of interest on that? How's the funding mechanism work? I guess as people hear you talk about giving out these grants, you know, there's always the question, how long can it last?
Yes. Well, it is a gift of stock and cash that we were given by the foundation. And yes, to answer your question, the earnings, the stock that the bank has is paying a dividend, and that supports our operating expense, plus provides funding for giving as well. But the stock has appreciated in value as well, and we're very pleased and proud about that, and certainly we hope to continue giving well into the future.
All right. So, folks, again, your website, just before we'll say this a couple more times, so people, if they're out there and they want to know more about, perhaps they're involved in something that they think a grant might be appropriate.
Yes. Our website is www.firstfedcf.org. firstfedcf.org. That's the website. You have everything that you could need for a grant and all the information, and Jan's contact as well.
Right. Now, do you, as a board then, do you actually sit down and go through some of this? Maybe describe, kind of a tough time,
I suppose,
when you have all of these requests and you only have so much you can give.
Yes, we do. And Jan does a great job of encapsulating everything for us and making sure that we have access to everything that was submitted to us. Our board members are all very dedicated to the communities that we serve. And I know I read through all of those applications as a board member. Our process, however, to make it even more effective, once the application window closes and everything is compiled, it is submitted not only to board members, but we have an advisory committee, too. And this committee is composed primarily of the management, some of the managers of First Federal, who live in the communities that we serve. And that allows us to get their on the ground perspective from them. Our employees, the bank employees, have always been very involved in their communities, and they have their finger on the pulse of the needs in those communities. So the advisory committee goes over those applications and makes recommendations and provides us feedback as a board on the applications we received. And then we get together, all of us, review very carefully and have a robust discussion about the applications. Because as you can imagine, when you get 4 to 5 times the amount of requests than there is money, it's not an easy task.
Well, one that did pass through is the Forks Food Bank. And we have Pat Soderlund here, who's from the food bank, joining us to talk a bit about that organization as well as how the grant has helped them. Pat, it's great to talk to you again. Thanks for coming on today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be able to talk about something that's so passionate.
So describe it. You got some help. You've gotten a grant from the foundation. Maybe we'll start there. Talk a bit about what that has helped you do out at the Forks Food Bank.
Well, we've, because of the pandemic and low donations and things that had happened during that time, our budget was really stressed. And so we were seeing a higher need of purchasing food items that we were no longer able to get. So with that being said, our local branch had reached out to me, First Federal, and said, we do have a grant that's available, so would you be interested in applying? So we reached out, applied for the grant, and it was amazing. They were so incredibly helpful and so kind, and we did get the grant. It was for $25,000.
And that money is going, tell us a bit about how you've spent it so far, I guess.
Okay, so because of the onset of COVID, yeah, we're still doing the drive-through method. And so the packages for families 1 to 2, 3 to 5, and 6 and up are pre-packed, and so when they drive through, we're able to go ahead and pull them up and give them out. With that being said, we've used this money to purchase food for the prepackaged families, and we've also started what we call a meal kit program. What we've discovered is that a lot of times folks are really unsure of what to prepare or how to prepare it. And so what we've done is we've developed a meal package program kit to where we're putting kits together for the 1 to 2, 3 to 5, and 6 and up families. And in these kits is a recipe for that week with all of the food items that you can get for the food bank, from the food bank. And then we put this in their package. And this actually will last them for 3 to 5 days.
Amazing. Tell us about the Forks Food Bank. I mean, we're familiar in our where we're at with PA and the Squim Food Bank, but what's your service area, quote unquote, out there? How many folks are you taking care of? Give us a description kind of who you're helping out there.
Okay. Well, before, in the very beginning, over 50 years ago, when we were serving the public, it was pretty much a desperate measure to help out just for those who were in need, and that's changed over time. So our numbers have increased at least 3 times in the last 2 years of what we had been seeing before. So typically our distribution is every Tuesday and Thursday from 3 to 5:30, and we were seeing about anywhere from 14 to maybe 40 a week. And now it's 60 and 80 and sometimes 120 every Tuesday and Thursday.
Wow. And that is that driven by a couple of factors? I'm sure people are having a hard time right now. Also growth in the area? I mean, the population simply has gotten larger out there, too, like everywhere.
Well, it has. I'm not quite sure about the population, because I know that our population in the greater, city area is 3,400, but we also serve the outlying areas. So this side of Lake Crescent, so the entire West End. And I know that there are tribal food banks here that help the tribes. And then also Colum Bay has a food bank and they help that area. But we could get them basically anywhere from, like I said, Lake Crescent on, and even a portion of Jefferson County, because they're out there on the other end of it and they're a little bit remote. So we do help them. So if they come, we help.
Yeah, it's amazing. And COVID has been just really a tough time for food banks in general. It sounds like you needed the help you got, and you're kind of back on your feet, I guess, suffice to say, as best you can.
Yes, we are. We're really actually doing quite well. Before the onset of COVID, we were just a simple, small, basic needs food bank, and that's changed us considerably. What we now have become is a major distribution center for the West End. So a lot of the food comes in for the tribal communities. They'll come into the Forks Food Bank, and then they'll show up, and then we distribute all their food to them.
It's amazing, and I know you're touching a lot of folks out there as well. Pat, great to talk to you. Just to bring this full circle, we'll go back to Karen, and maybe you can describe it. I mean, this does fit one of those categories specifically that you talked about. You know, I don't want to say no-brainer, but makes some sense when an application like the Forks Food Bank comes in for you to take that up.
It certainly did, Todd. This was a community support grant, and we made this one, again, under the auspices of the pandemic relief funding that we made. We provided a lot more to the community support category to meet those needs, and we saw what the Forks Food Bank and also several of the other food banks in our area have been struggling with since the pandemic. I mean, the need just skyrocketed. So this definitely met our criteria.
All right. Karen's great to talk to you. Karen McCormick there, and glad to see you're plugged in still.
Yes.
You can never retire. You know that, right? So I appreciate you coming on to talk about the foundation with the First Federal's Community Foundation. And Pat Soderlund, it's great to talk to you out at Forks, too, with the Forks Food Bank. Thanks for sharing the story and making people aware about what the foundation is out doing these days.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a break. We're going to talk about an interesting film out that you may want to watch out for. And it's about kind of the history of motorcycles and also a very unique race. And we're going to talk with a person who's put together this film, this documentary, if you will, and a reenactment might be a good way to put it. We'll talk with Cutler Gray about that right after this.
This is the Wardlaw Show on News Radio KONP.
I'm Renee Worthy, Executive Director at Parkview Villas, voted the peninsula's best assisted living community 14 years in a row. It's more than just a place to retire. It's a new home for you that truly allows you to relax and enjoy a healthy, independent lifestyle. So don't wait. Call or stop by and see us today. 452-7222 for retirement and care beyond your expectations. Come experience Parkview Villas.
Over a million customers at Flagstar Bank, based in Michigan, are now being warned that they may have had information stolen in a hack. It happened last year, but the bank says it didn't start notifying anyone until now because it was investigating. Some of the information stolen includes names and social security numbers. The bank is offering 2 years of identity theft monitoring.
All right, welcome back to the program. I'm going to spend the next segment or so talking with Cutler Gray, who has put together a film called The Motorcycle Illustrated. And it really is a very interesting take on kind of the evolution of motorcycles and specifically about a race that was put together way back when. Cutler, good to have you on. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Todd. Yeah, it's great to be here.
So let's talk about your project, this film that you've put together called The Motorcycle Illustrated. Maybe best that you describe how you got involved with this and what this partakes, because it really is a reenactment of an historic event. And anybody who's a motorcycle enthusiast, this literally kind of rolls it back to the beginning of a modern motorcycle.
Yeah, exactly. I found out that my great-grandfather raced with Walter Davidson of Harley-Davidson back in the day in endurance runs. And so at the end of college, I built a motorized bicycle and rode it up the coast from Los Angeles to Seattle to recreate his journeys.
And it's quite interesting. Now, there's a couple of trailers that I watched as well. Describe the motorized bicycle that you you put together for this, because you were authentic as best you could in doing this, you know, route as well as the vehicle.
Yeah, so my great-grandfather, Buck Ducell, he was riding when they first invented motorcycles. So to stay true to that, I just had a beach cruiser, and I basically just bolted a four-stroke engine to it and started riding.
What made you, other than, you know, you thought this would be kind of cool to do, I guess I'll say, what possessed you to do this? Because it wasn't just hopping on a bike and going.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, a combination of things. Really, I wanted to kind of tell my great-grandfather's story through our journey. And also, you know, I felt like it was a great way to get to know him through doing what he did. I mean, he passed before I was born, but, you know, the race he was in that I have documented pretty well was way back in 1908. So a large portion of it was to, you know, just recreate something that happened over 100 years ago and see how it went.
Now, I know that through your journey in doing this, you got the hardships, you had things break down, you had all of that happen during it as well, which, you know, probably was exactly kind of some of the things that your grandfather dealt with too, although you had a little bit more modern convenience perhaps than he did.
Yeah, absolutely. We found ourselves staying in KOAs and, you know, occasionally we did have to pitch a tent and camp on the side of the road, but it was really interesting in doing the research and then looking back at our trip, you know, finding out all of the similarities that happened between, you know, both of our rides and also the general atmosphere of motorcycling back in the day when they were figuring out what these machines could do.
That was my next question, the figuring out part as well. I mean, literally, it's taking a bicycle and putting a motor on it, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just like they were doing back in the day when they were figuring out these machines. And, you know, we were along the side of the road, you know, swapping out engines and fixing the chains and making sure the handlebars were on straight. And it was quite the adventure. So, sometimes riding till 4 a.m. in the morning.
Wow. All right. So describe your motorcycle and kind of what you learned from it. I would think as you put it together and you hopped on it for the first time, could you describe that a little bit? Were you surprised by how it ran or didn't run or anything like that?
Yeah, well, I found myself, you know, a week before we had to leave and the bike didn't work. So I really had to kind of kick it into gear to finish the build. And once I did that and I got riding, I was like thinking, okay, this is going to be great. I'm just going to go to the coastline, hit the gas, and I'll ride, you know, 1,000 miles. We got about, you know, 150 miles in before we had our first breakdown. And then it was, you know, every 50 miles beyond that, we broke down at least. And, you know, so the bike is just a beach cruiser, a pretty standard metal frame. And I literally drilled a couple holes into it and attached an engine. And yeah, so you can imagine all of the little repairs that we needed to do along the way. Duct tape, zip ties, pretty much anything we could do to keep the thing together is what we did.
Wow. Now, where did you get the engine for it? Describe that, if you will. It was a four cycle, but you know, what was the size of it?
It is a 49cc engine. Mm-hmm. I did get a kit bike to help me build it, but basically, it just needed a ton of custom fabrication as well. You know, the things aren't really designed extremely well, and that's kind of half the joy we found along the way with the trip, was that you know, like, it wasn't perfect, but it got us there, and it helped us do what we needed to do, and that was half the joy of the trip.
Did you use the stock wheels, chain, all of that that came with it? You had, how much modernization or modification did you have to do of your actual frame and such?
Yeah, we basically had to drill holes in it, and then I added a ton of additional aluminum framing to it to make it stable and keep the engine in place. And yeah, it was just pretty basic, you know. It's tried to stay as true to the idea of a motorized bicycle as possible.
So did you have some sort of plans that, you know, were based on what your grandfather was doing, just so you could, you know, have an authentic experience with your motorized bicycle or not?
Absolutely. We were trying to recreate what they called endurance runs back in the day. So this was at the advent of motorcycling. They had these competitions in which a ton of riders would get together, and they had, you know, to cover 150 miles a day. They had certain checkpoints they had to meet and timings they had to match. And the goal wasn't necessarily for them to do it the fastest they could, but do it in the right amount of time. So we tried to stay as close to schedule as possible, but at the end of the trip, we found out kind of how amazing it was that they were able to do what they did back in the day, because we had a ton of trouble. And we also kind of applied, there was a point system they used. And so we kind of applied the point system of that competition to our ride. And it's pretty hilarious to see how short we came of those goals.
Then on top of all of this, unlike what happened in 1908, you're making a film out of this as well. So describe some of the challenge of doing a documentary while you're also trying to kind of recreate this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was extremely tight quarters. You know, I was riding the bike. I had three of my buddies from film school driving my van, which had all of our camping material, all the extra bike parts and everything. And, you know, obviously camping in a tent along the way. My brother came along to drive behind me to protect me from traffic because, you know, the bike doesn't go really fast enough to stay out of a lot of people's way. But, you know, there's all the typical kind of tensions you would have with a tight-knit group of people who are spending, you know, literally 24 hours a day together. So tensions are high, jokes are made, shenanigans happen. So it was a ton of fun.
And you're dealing with mechanical failures, as you mentioned, let alone electronic things that have to go, you know, if anybody's been shooting any sort of a film knows that there are issues that happen with that as well. I have to say, you know, looking at the trailers that you have out, you've got some fabulous footage out of this. What did you shoot with mostly? You know, how did you get some of this footage?
Oh, man, my cinematographer, Michael Alfuso, is fantastic. He's an action sports videographer. Mm-hmm. And he kind of came from the world of skateboard videos. And actually, he used, you know, some Canon cameras, some really nice lenses. And, you know, generally, though, it's just, you know, being in the right place at the right time and anticipating certain things that are bound to happen. And he just was the right man for the job.
All right. What was the top speed on your quote-unquote motorcycle?
Downhill or uphill?
Maybe both.
Yeah, so uphill we sometimes got up to about, you know, 35, and downhill you could get up to about 55, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah. For
a little rickety bike, you know, so about as fast as you'd want to go.
Before we run out of time, I have to ask you this, though, because you get this modified bicycle, essentially, with a motor on it, with this big engine on it. How tipsy was that? How difficult was it for you to stay balanced and to kind of, and I'm sure you kind of got it after you did it for a while, but that must have been kind of a different feel.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like you feel kind of like you're on a regular bicycle because the wheels are fairly narrow. You can get your legs around the frame, but it weighs quite a bit more because of all the extra mechanical parts. So it was a little bit of a learning curve, and I had a couple mishaps along the way. But for the most part, we stayed upright, and it worked out pretty well.
All right. People, when they watch this, what do you hope they take away from your documentary?
Well, I hope they can just come along for the ride and enjoy the trip. And also, you know, I hope that they can learn something about the motorcyclists of the past. And, you know, those pioneers that came before us.
Yeah, it was a different breed, certainly, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, how did somebody get a look at this? This is coming out. Where can we find the Motorcycle Illustrated?
Yeah, it's out for pre-order right now on iTunes. So if you go to iTunes trailers and look up The Motorcycle Illustrated, it'll be on there. You could also go to my website, themotorcycleillustrated.com, all one word. And yeah, check out the trailer. I have a 3-minute trailer up there, and there's a pre-order link right there. That is the best way to do it.
And I'll tell folks that after watching the trailer, it's beautiful scenery and things as well. So even if you're not a real motorcycle aficionado, it's the trip itself is worth watching, I think, at least from what I'm seeing in the trailer. So I'll throw that out for folks.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And yeah, it's totally also a great look at the coastline and the beautiful one along the route.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Cutler, great. Thanks for sharing a little of your story. Glad you're all healed up and everything's back in order and the movie's out. All right, I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much, Todd. Have a good day.
You too. That's Cutler Gray. He has put together the movie, The Motorcycle Illustrated. As he mentioned, do check it out. Probably the best thing to do, go to themotorcycleillustrated.com and you can check it out and look for it on iTunes as well. And it really is a fascinating documentary and a look at early days of motorcycling. It's not quite what it is today. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a bit.
This is the Todd Ortloff Show on News Radio KONP.
A former top aide to Chief of Staff Mark Meadows testified before the House Select Committee today, telling members former President Trump and his top advisors knew about the potential for violence on January 6th when supporters marched from the rally to the U.S. Capitol. Cassidy Hutchinson also testified that the former president had an altercation with his security detail.
Former top White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson saying several Secret Service agents described Donald Trump's rage inside his secure car when an agent refused to drive him to join the January 6th Capitol marchers.
The president said something to the effect of, "I'm the effing president, take me up to the Capitol now."
And then agents told Hutchinson that Mr. Trump tried to strangle Agent Bobby Engel.
Mr. Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards Bobby Engel.
Hutchinson saying other agents verified that account was true. Andy Field, ABC News, Washington.
In a post to his Truth Social site, the former president denied Hutchinson's claims. I'm Michelle Franz in ABC News.
Here's your News Radio KONP forecast. Scattered rain showers likely this afternoon, otherwise overcast skies. Highs level off around 66, winds out of the southeast, 5 to 10 miles per hour. Partly cloudy skies tonight, scattered rain showers likely, lows level off around 55. Chance for scattered rain showers again tomorrow. Highs level off around 61, overcast skies. I'm weatherology meteorologist Paul Trombley. Currently, it's 64 degrees.
Coming soon, full car detailing services at Red Carpet Car Wash in Carlsberg. Get all high-end interior and exterior detailing services done at Red Carpet. Engine bay cleaning and even headlight restoration and paint correction will be available too. Interior detail services starting as low as $130. You won't find that price anywhere else. Let us give your vehicle the royal treatment. Stay tuned in here and keep an eye on our Facebook page for our grand opening of the Red Carpet Car Wash. Full detail shop.
Going to talk a little bit about trees, especially in an urban setting. And so we're going to dive into it as a development of a street tree program here in the city of Port Angeles. It's a partnership between City Shade and the city, and we have a couple of folks involved on both sides of that to join us today. Paul Forrest is with us with the City Shade program, and we have Thomas Hunter, who's the Public Works and Utilities Director for the city of Port Angeles, coming on board as well. Thanks both for coming on today. Paul, I'll start with you. Tell us a bit about City Shade and just kind of how you got involved with this and what this is leading to here for the city of Port Angeles.
My wife and I visited the historical museum here in about 2007, and I was looking at photographs of old Port Angeles, and I commented that, gee, I think there were more trees then than there are now, which I think is true. If you drive down the average block, count the trees on both sides of the street, you might get up to 5 on the average block, maybe only 4, and there are many places that don't have any, so we have lots of space for trees. So I decided to grow trees for a street tree project that could be free for people in Port Angeles.
And I understand you've literally planted hundreds of trees so far. Is that right?
I have hundreds of trees growing, but none of these have been planted in town.
All right. So, but that's the next part of this program. So, Thomas Hunter, let's talk a bit about how the city is now getting engaged with this and what you envision happening next.
Yeah, Todd. Well, I think that it's really important to highlight just kind of what an amazing process this is from our perspective. You know, Paul reached out to us quite some time ago, as I referenced in an earlier council meeting. I can't believe it's taken as long as it has, but I think good things usually do. And Paul had this idea of how we could really combine volunteerism, combine community effort, and really capture some benefit relative to urban tree canopy and increasing that. At the same time, we had to put a lot of thought and due diligence into how we could make this a process that's easy for the community, that's not overly burdensome, that has some rhythm and rhyme to it, so to speak, all set within the context of, as you know, our very complex rights of way. So we started this conversation quite some time ago, and we've just now kind of reached the point where we're feeling better about it. We've kind of got a concept as to how people are going to be able to ultimately apply to be a part of this program. Paul and his team over at City Shade really feel that they're going to be able to, you know, go through the tree planting process with people and outline best management practices relative to maintaining those trees and so forth. So that's not to say that there aren't more details to figure out. Simply put, we're getting farther along in this process, and we're really excited about this partnership.
All right. So, Thomas, now that you've kind of laid that out, let's take me through, you know, what an application might look like, who might be eligible. As you mentioned, it may not be for every parcel in the city of Port Angeles, per se.
Yeah, I think one of the critical pieces of importance is really coming up with a roadmap. And so we're working right now, the Public Works Department, City Shade, and the CED Department, looking at how we can divide up different parts of the city and the different neighborhoods to identify which areas would go first from an application perspective. We want to make sure that we're creating consistency within these communities. And again, we're a little ways off from the exact details on that. But putting all of that out in front of the application process is going to be critically important. And there's been a lot of work kind of that's gone into the, you know, what types of trees and all of that. Paul can speak a little bit more to that part.
And Paul, that was my next question, is these are, you know, depending on where we're talking about, might be a different kind of tree for a different kind of neighborhood.
The trees that I'm growing all came from the city's list of recommended street trees.
Okay.
Exclusively. So, and these trees are one of the main features of these trees, or some of the features, are that they're all deciduous, so you can get some sunshine through the canopy in the wintertime. They're all single trunk, and they do not buckle the sidewalks and the curbs. They have deep roots, so they're not like conifers that stretch out and tear everything up. So we'd like them to be good stewards of these trees, to be good neighbors, you know. But I think we have about 5 species we're working with at the moment. We did have 10, but we had some problems. We can, you know, I don't think on any given street you want to have 5 different kinds of trees planted on the street. Maybe this street we do one type, and another street we do another type, and let the neighbors on the street decide what they want.
Okay, so I, you know, say we're going to do this in my neighborhood, Paul. When you come out, what are you going to teach me how to grow this tree? How big's this tree going to be when you plant it? What would take me through what this might look like for an actual person once the program's going and maybe they get accepted into bringing a tree on?
Well, we'll have to have people trained to do that. You would apply online to get a tree and give a little bit of information. Somebody would show up at your property and look at the site and make sure the tree that you'd like to plant is not too big, not too little, is not too close to the curb or the sidewalk or a fire hydrant or the corner of the street. So you get the right tree in the right place at the right time.
Do you help, are you at least looking into this, and maybe either one of you, Paul first, if you want to answer this. You know, I'm talking about people might get a little, well, geez, I'm going to plant that tree, and all of a sudden not there goes my view, for example. Are you taking into any consideration sight lines, things like that, or types of trees that might grow in a certain place better than another and not be impactful, I guess, if you will, to a neighbor's property?
Well, when you plant a tree in your neighborhood or in your backyard, you do have to consider what the neighbors might think, and especially the ones if you potentially are blocking a view. The first thing I did when I looked at the city street tree list was eliminate all the tall trees that go beyond 60 feet, because those really do tick off the neighbors. So
yeah,
we're going to plant small and medium-sized trees only.
Thomas, I'm going to have you maybe elaborate, too, on something Paul just said about, you know, from the public works perspective. One of the issues, I think, that led to a lot of trees being removed was what he just talked about with buckling of pavement. You know, the root systems became problematic. That's a fact, isn't it?
Well, it definitely is, Todd, and I think that's why there's going to have to be a lot of care put into multiple stages of this program. But you know, one of the things that I think is important for us to realize is that we need to make progress in this arena, and perfection isn't always going to be the result in stage one. But you know, City Shade and Paul has done a lot of work using city resources to come up with a list that is going to bait a lot of those concerns. The other thing that is going to be of critical importance is that these trees are maintained by the property owners appropriately. And those materials are being are in draft form right now. We're anticipating potentially making some minor code changes to bring forward to council that adopt some best management practices for residential tree planting and maintenance. And Todd, honestly, one of the areas that I find the most success with any program is when you're really doing something on a volunteer basis. And in this situation, you have people willingly applying to be a part of this program. They're invested in the long-term health of this program and of these trees. And I think for that reason, we're gonna see some really good maintenance you know, taking place of these systems. And I think because of that, it'll abate a lot of those fears.
I think people might be surprised at just the importance. Why the are we still a tree city? We had been at one point declared that, but there maybe you can talk a bit about that, Thomas, and just kind of the importance of the city has had efforts in the past of trying to, you know, become more urban forest friendly, so to speak.
Yeah, Todd, we are still a tree city, and I think that this is another step in that direction. That has been something that has been led by the Community and Economic Development Department here at the city. But I think this is just another way for the city to kind of put its foot forward and continue that legacy. None of it would have been possible, however, without City Shade, Paul's contribution. And I think contribution is almost an understatement. He's really been pushing us hard. Few people go out and plant as many trees as he has prior to a program being initiated. So it's just
You know, Thomas, he's planted 100 trees. He's got 100 trees growing already. So I think he's put skin in the game, as they say. And then some.
Let me make a comment here. Going into the spring, I had about maybe almost 2,000 trees, and I now have very healthy 1,200.
Oh, wow. So there you go. I should have asked you this earlier, Paul. How large are your seedlings now? I mean, how big are these trees right now?
I have a fair number that are in the 4-foot going on to 5-foot range. And then some that are only, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 feet tall.
Go ahead.
City Shade is committed to providing the trees to the city. They have to be at least 6 feet tall, and 4 inches from the ground, they need to be at least 1-inch caliper.
Paul, I should have asked you at the outset of this, what is your background in trees before doing all of this with City Shade?
Well, I've spent some time around nurseries, but not that many. But I'm an agronomist, and I've worked in agriculture and agribusiness and agricultural lending and crop production in several parts of the United States, and then in about 19 countries overseas.
So there you go. So there's a bit of a background, or at least even into the more commercialness of this whole thing as to putting a program together that will be sustainable. Thomas, I wanted to have you elaborate, too, or maybe just comment on what Paul said at the beginning when he was looking at maps of Port Angeles, and there seemed to be so much more canopy back in the day. What happened? And maybe it's not just Port Angeles, but in a lot of cities. Why did we, you know, what was the thrust to get rid of all of the trees, I guess?
Well, you know, Todd, I think that there's some professors at prestigious universities that study this topic for a living. You know, the idea of urban sprawl and, you know, right. All of the different land management actions that have come from those sorts of things. But I think just in general, you know, what you've seen over the past decade or so is a lot of communities trying to turn that tide.
That's right.
And recognizing the not only the environmental, but the social value of having an urban canopy and treating that type of program or infrastructure, if you will, in a little bit different light than it was maybe say 20, 30 years ago. So I think that's exciting. I think we have a lot of examples out there of communities that have been making that a priority. And you're starting to see some of the benefits of it.
Do you think, Thomas, that also makes it easier to get a program like the one you're proposing now to get some legs and to actually work? People are going to be more, you know, buying into it because of the social issues that come with it now.
Well, certainly. And I think that anytime you have examples out there of other communities to kind of use as a template is a really good thing. But, you know, one of the things that I think is unique about this program and special is this partnership in creating the sheer amount of volunteerism that's going to go into it, having buy-in from the adjacent property owners to be a part of that process. And the fact that, you know, as long as the program is sustainable, you're looking at you know, free trees. There will be a donation component that'll be worked in there, but I think that in and of itself puts its own unique Port Angeles spin on it and something that our community can really get behind.
All right, Thomas, what is the timeline from the city's perspective? Where do you think we're at in all of this before people can start just maybe sign up, do some things, or can they do some things right now?
Well, I think that we're still a little ways off from people signing up. I think that we need to spend the summer and maybe early fall kind of finalizing what the application process is going to look like. The last thing we want to do is to have people log in online and all of a sudden there's a bunch of hiccups. So we need to figure that part of it out. Ultimately, what we're looking at is opening up application for these trees next spring. And collecting that those applications for a short period of time, and then ultimately due diligence in late spring and summer on all the things that Paul brought up relative to the placement of those trees. And then October of 2023 would be the first planting for this program.
All right, Paul, we'll go to you probably for some of the last words on this. By that time, I mean, you're going to have what? You got 1,200. You'll probably have 2,400 trees by then. What do you think?
I don't know how many I'll have then growing, but by October of 23, I should have, you know, maybe 100 trees to start off the first year, which would be nice, a nice test, so that then the following year, if we have 400 or 500 trees, we'll know what to do.
Paul, are you excited about this thing? Is this coming together as you had hoped, as you'd like, as you envisioned it, or is it not? Or is it something totally more than you thought it'd be?
No, this is really great. It's become bigger and more complicated than I ever imagined, and it's going to last longer than I ever thought. But I'm 75, and I need something to keep me driving, to keep in shape the next 4 or 5 years.
Well, I can tell you, Paul, that we were looking for an excuse to get you on to talk about this for some time, and we finally were able to get you and then the city on and to chat all about the street tree program and what City Shade's done with it. And hats off to you, Paul, for kind of bringing this forward, and I appreciate you sharing a little insight. I think we'll probably have some follow-up to this as we go. Obviously, this program's still kind of being put together, and I don't know, maybe you need to give me an update on how many trees you have growing every couple of months.
I could do that. Yeah,
I'd love to do it. Paul, thanks for joining us. It was great to talk to you. And Thomas Hunter from the city, it's always great to talk to you as well. And again, yeah, we'll continue to follow this. And sounds like things are moving along. And about a year from now, we could be pretty active with this.
Absolutely. Thank you, Todd.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. And that's a little bit about the developing street tree program through the city of Port Angeles and City Shade there. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with more on our program in just a moment.
This is the Todd Ortloff Show on News Radio KONP.
Red Carpet Car Wash is not just a car wash. They wash everything, and I mean everything. The manual wash bays are large enough to fit motorhomes, logging trucks, and dump trucks, too. They even have the doggy wash station, so your family pooch is just as clean as your vehicle. And when the outside looks so good, you'll want the inside to match, too. Take advantage of our professional detailing on vehicles of all sizes. Red Carpet Car Wash in Carlsberg, Monday through Friday, 8 till 6, Saturday and Sunday, 9 till 5.
You want to feel important.
You want to be part of something bigger, something that matters and can help change things.
You want to feel like you belong.
We know. We felt that way too. And that's why we did something about it.
We aren't just Army National Guard soldiers. We are normal people just like you.
But our part-time service in the Army National Guard means we get to be more.
When our communities are in need, we get the chance to stand up and do something about it.
We get to serve in our own region and help the people we call neighbors.
From the mountains of Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, and Utah.
The deserts of Arizona and Nevada. The Pacific coasts of Washington, Oregon, and California.
To the wilderness of Alaska and islands of Hawaii and Guam.
We are here. Here for our hometowns.
And together, we can make a difference.
Take on your legacy. Visit NationalGuard.com to find out more.
Sponsored by the Washington Army National Guard. Aired by the Washington State Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Black, Latino, and other renters of color are typically submitting more applications and paying more in fees before they secure a place to live compared to white renters. That's according to Zillow's Consumer Housing Trends Report. It found renters of color paid a median security deposit of $750 compared to $600 paid by white renters.
Coast to Coast AM catches more flies with vinegar than honey.
I have some concerns about these questions.
Are you too tired to enjoy summer? Well, don't be. Listen in to Doc Wallach from CriticalHealthNews.com as he tells us some tips on how to stay healthy. Later on, what your nightmares are telling you with Delphi Ellis on Coast to Coast.
That's the recipe for great radio on Coast to Coast AM.
Coast to Coast AM, every night at 10 on KONP.
The North Peninsula's News. The North Peninsula.